This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Life on the road as a touring musician is tough, especially if you start that right out of high school.
I remember, like, I was having anxiety attacks and stuff and all this terrible stuff. You know, my chest was locking up. I'm like, oh, geez, what's going on with me?
Bloomington Normal's Matthew Curry talks with John Norton about getting used to the life. Plus, the director of the ACLU of Illinois, Colleen Connell, visits ahead of a community appearance. She talks about challenges to civil liberties in coming years. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One big winner from the election of Donald Trump as president, if you want to call it a win, is the American Civil Liberties Union. Membership has soared in Illinois from about 14,000 before the election last year to 70,000 plus. That has created challenges for the ACLU to communicate with these new members and make sure the venerable organization is addressing its interests and needs. One way to do that is a tour of listening sessions, and it is Bloomington Normal's turn for the We the People listening tour. That's this evening at the Chateau Hotel and Conference Center. Joining us in studio is Colleen Connell, the executive director of the ACLU of Illinois. Welcome.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
Who are these new members and where do they come from?
Well, they come from across the state of Illinois. And when I say across the state, we have members in every state legislative district and every congressional district. And who they are is just about everybody from almost every walk of life. I got a letter the other day from a retired gentleman down near the Carbondale area who said he'd never before been a member or contributed to the ACLU, but that he was so concerned about what was happening in this country and the threats to constitutional rights and liberties that he was motivated to join the ACLU. And that sentiment has echoed throughout the membership surge that we've seen. People have said, I've always intended to join. I really care about what I see the ACLU doing, but it feels like the threat is very real to the constitutional rights that really provide the glue that bind us together as Americans.
What's been the change in membership in McLean County?
I want to say it's come close to tripling.
Okay. You've already done sessions in Springfield, Peoria, and Champaign. What issues are emerging from those?
And we see a common concern about voting rights, about the rights of immigrants, particularly the rights of young undocumented immigrants who are referred to colloquially as dreamers. We see a very serious concern about women's reproductive freedom and a real concern about LGBT rights. And I think we are also sensing a pervasive concern about the unwillingness of the Trump administration to abide by the checks and balances that are definitional of our democracy, and this recognition that this is a government of laws, not of men or of a man. And people are just concerned about what that portends for our democracy.
Do you expect different issues to rise in Bloomington Normal?
Not really. I've been surprised in some ways by the consistency of the issues that we've seen across the state. And one other issue that I would put in there that comes across loud and clear is the concern about racial justice, particularly in the context of policing. in each of the communities that we have made part of our listening tour, we have heard concerns expressed about disproportionate policing that focuses on African Americans and Latinos. And we have seen real concern about the fact that young black men, for example, are arrested at, you know, much greater rates than their representation in the population. And there's been that concern that is resonating loud and clear in every visit that we make.
The Illinois law that allows collection of that racial data on traffic stops, searches, and seizures and arrests is due to expire.
It is.
It was a tough lift the first two times. Is it likely to be so again?
We are concerned about it, but it is an issue that is very important to our almost 75,000 members, and it'll be a focal point of the ACLU's legislative agenda for the 2018 spring session. And it's really been an important law from a variety of contexts, not just in terms of, you know, documenting the disproportionate impact of stops in minority communities, but also in terms of good policing and accountability, which citizens across the state and across all racial groups really care about.
The data in Bloomington Normal shows clearly that there is, as it is statewide, a disproportionate effect on minorities in the number of people stopped and the number of searches asked for, and minorities are less likely to have contraband when searched in Bloomington Normal than the general run of the population or Anglo stopped people. This is a matter of some contention. Law enforcement tends to say, okay, yeah, that exists, but that doesn't really reflect how we police, because we're in high service neighborhoods when we do that. Is there a way to get better data, and is there a bipartisan way to adjust the law to drill down to a question that everyone wants answered, an even-handed police enforcement process?
Well, that argument by law enforcement is internally inconsistent. If they claim that the reason that they are stopping more people of color is because they are in high crime neighborhoods, that notion that they are stopping the right people is rebutted by the fact that you just pointed out, which again is consistent statewide, that people of color are less likely to be carrying contraband than Anglos. And so they're stopping the wrong people. You know, they're stopping a lot of people who are completely innocent, and they're not making good what we call shorthand Terry stops. They're not stopping people, you know, for whom there's a reasonable suspicion or even probable cause that a crime has been committed. And that's what we have found consistently. We found that in the city of Chicago, and we found that, again, sort of across law enforcement in the state of Illinois. And a couple effects have come out in a number of the other communities that we visited. And again, this has also come out in the city of Chicago a couple of years ago, specifically with respect to marijuana, arrests for marijuana, which is that young black men of color are often stopped, frisked, and sometimes arrested for offenses that young Anglo men are not. You know, we were presented with data in one of the communities we visited where young black men were basically cited for, wait for it, jaywalking or walking in the street when a sidewalk was available for walking. And
pretextual stops.
Pretextual stops. Exactly. So from my standpoint, good law enforcement, even-handed law enforcement, law enforcement that is not racially biased is something that ought to be a bipartisan issue. People who are Republicans and people who are Democrats all should care about good, even-handed policing and policing that's consistent with the Constitution.
The city of Bloomington recently created a public safety citizen review board. Is that an increasingly common tool around the state? Has that borne good fruit, in your opinion?
It is an increasingly popular phenomenon that's been happening nationwide, and it's a very important development in terms of police accountability. But our concern is that these citizen oversight boards have real teeth to them and that they have an ability to see with great transparency the data that's produced about stops, about frisks, about arrests, about crime statistics, because it's only when citizen boards have access to the data, again, the importance of the Traffic and Pedestrian Stop Statistical Study Act, which is up for renewal this year, and then actually have some authority to insist on accountability and the ability to discipline law enforcement when the rules are not being followed, when the law is not being followed. We want to avoid situations like we have seen in Chicago, where disciplinary actions against law enforcement by oversight boards in the past have not proved effective, and where we see after the fact the city of Chicago has paid out more than $500 million over the last 6 or 7 years for in lawsuit damages for people who were harmed or in some cases died as a result of police misconduct or excessive use of force.
This task would be a lot easier with law enforcement cultural buy-in. How can that be achieved?
Well, we have actually worked very hard on that, and it's very important to note that law enforcement, both in Illinois and nationwide, does not necessarily oppose all of these measures. And the common ground we have here is we all care about community safety, and we ought to all care about abiding by the law. And we should hold law enforcement to those same standards as we hold everyone else.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're with Colleen Connell, the executive director of the ACLU of Illinois. Again, about the membership bulge, civil libertarians come from the right as well as the left. Do you know whether you have experienced a similar boost in membership from people who are on the zero government side of civil liberties as well as those opposing President Trump?
That isn't an issue on which we have any data. But I can say from experience and talking to members across the state that there has always been a significant number of ACLU members who view themselves as libertarians. And they view the U.S. Constitution, for example, as for what it really is, which is a negative constitution that puts real restraints on the amount of power that we, the people, give to government. And so there's always been that strain of restricted government power that courses through many ACLU members.
How, with so many new members coming from the other side of the political spectrum, will you continue to honor that constituency?
Because we strongly believe that the Constitution applies with equal force to people regardless of their religion, their race, their ethnicity, their gender. And that is going to be a considerable part of the ACLU's agenda for the foreseeable future. It is really, quite frankly, the essence of who we are. And it's not so inconsistent, Charlie, because Most of the time in this country's history, the force of government has been used in a way that disproportionately affects minorities, whether it's religious minorities, racial minorities, and in many cases, women, you know, who have not had the amount of political or economic power historically that men have had. And so much of the ACLU's historical work has been to make sure that the Constitution applies with equal force in limiting government power that's attempted to be asserted against minority groups.
Voter access laws, of course, a big issue for the ACLU nationally. It's come up from time to time in Illinois, not notably in the last couple of years, although State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington, a Republican, has lobbied for voter registration laws as part of his belief system and effort. Do you see that arising in Illinois under the Trump-Rauner Republican ascendancy?
So I'm going to try to unpack that in a couple of different ways. There already are voter registration laws in effect in Illinois. But the experience has been a couple of times in the recent memory to actually expand voter access rather than constrict it. So recently, for example, the Illinois General Assembly passed a law that allows for election day voter registration. First was a pilot program, but now basically at least, you know, the central voting place, the county seat in every Illinois county has to allow election day voter registration. And counties with a large population, such as Cook, have to make that option available really in every voting place. We also had a law that was passed, vetoed by Governor Rauner the first time around. There were some changes made, and he signed it the second time around that allows for automatic voter registration when Illinois citizens access certain governmental services through state agencies. And so what we have seen in Illinois has been an expansion rather than a contraction of the right to register, to vote, and actually to vote.
In the news this week is a Supreme Court case on acquisition of GPS data from cell phone companies and whether a warrant with probable cause is necessary to get that information or whether law enforcement agencies can simply go ahead as part of the investigatory process under a lower standard that there are reasonable grounds for the records to be provided and that they're relevant and material to an investigation. The ACLU is a prominent part of that case. Why do you think that should require a warrant under the Fourth Amendment?
Because it is a search, and that's what the Fourth Amendment requires. The Fourth Amendment says, you know, that there shall not be unreasonable searches or seizures without a warrant. And as you know, were the government to try to search your landline records, it would need a warrant to get those records, essentially. And the fact that we are increasingly a cell phone society does not mean that the privacy and due process protections of the Fourth Amendment are obsolete. One could argue that they're more needed than ever before, given the pervasiveness of that technology and the increased ability of that technology to track the movements of individuals across this country. In fact, very importantly, the ACLU of Illinois was able to get passed in the Illinois General Assembly a bill a session ago that requires law enforcement to secure a warrant before they can access cell phone location data.
Should the nature of the information matter, though? If it's just a where were you, that kind of location, that's far less intrusive than a
Than the content?
Than the contents of a text or an email or a web search.
I would dispute that, Charlie.
Okay.
That location information is critically important, and it's one of the reasons, for example, that law enforcement has been required to get a warrant before they can attach the old bug to your car in the sort of the pre-cell phone, you know, or you know, GPS type of thing. You have to get a warrant before you can, you know, attach a beeper or a tracer to a car because the locational information can sometimes be, it often is, as revealing as actually the content of any specific communications.
Yeah, and let's distinguish that example, though, with the idea that that is something that they believe to be an ongoing criminal pattern and that they're seeking to determine that. This is comparable, it could be argued, to asking somebody where they were, which police are certainly entitled to do. You know, it's conduct that has already taken place.
But a person also has the right to decline under the Fifth Amendment to provide that information about their whereabouts. And so our Constitution, the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, were really set up, again, to provide the individual with protections against government surveillance and government overreach, unless the government can prove the kind of reasonable suspicion or probable cause standard that allows government to get a warrant in order to specifically target an individual for surveillance. And that really was put in place to protect, again, the individuals from government overreach, that we as citizens have a right of travel and communication that is to be free from government surveillance unless government can make a showing that they have reason to believe that a crime is or has been committed or is about to be committed to justify government's invasion of our personal sphere of privacy.
Technology is constantly shifting. What other areas of tech do you anticipate need to be litigated or decided in coming years?
Well, there are a number of really important issues, one of which is quite, you know, close to the cell phone tracking data, and that's the use of stingrays that simulate a cell tower so that government can sort of identify, you know, which signals or which telephone numbers are in an area. And so in addition to basically allowing perhaps, you know, targeted surveillance because they're ostensibly looking for, you know, my cell phone number or your cell phone number, it also allows government to identify, you know, literally, you know, tens or hundreds or maybe even thousands of people, completely innocent people in that area. And so, again, this piece of legislation that I was talking about, you know, really puts limitations on government use of these stingray devices. You know, other concerns are, of course, biometric information, facial recognition technology, for example, could be hugely invasive. And a bill that the ACLU helped get passed a number of years ago, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, we call it BIPA in our internal shorthand, put some real restrictions on the use of one's biometric information, including your face, facial features, and its use, by law enforcement or even by commercial, or I should say perhaps particularly by commercial entities, you know, who may want to profit out of their ability to identify and then market based around your biometric information.
Under our Constitution, it's far easier to use the Constitution to restrict government and law enforcement from use of such information. But isn't it a tougher lift to do business restrictions?
Very, very great question, Charlie. The quick answer is yes. Under the Constitution of the United States, which, as you point out, is directed at limiting government action. But the federal constitution is a floor, not a ceiling, for how many rights we can protect and how robustly we can protect those rights and interests. And again, as you point out, sometimes these commercial interests have the ability to have a much more immediate and sometimes even a more profound effect on common citizens' rights than government. And so the ACLU and other entities, but you know, particularly the ACLU, have been able to use state laws or develop state law protections that are directed at private businesses and private commercial entities.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Colleen Connell is the guest. She's the executive director of the ACLU of Illinois, an attorney in her own right. It's not just technology that changes. Rules and policies change as well. How might the end of net neutrality affect civil rights?
That's a very real threat. The lifting restrictions on both the speed with which information can be transmitted or will be transmitted, and giving a preference to preferred companies, perhaps customers of the internet service provider, or perhaps going one or two clicks further and restricting from access ideas or providers that the carrier doesn't agree with, poses a real threat to the free flow of information.
GLT lately told the story of Mohammed Mahmoud, an Egyptian citizen who was trying to come to Bloomington Normal to spend Thanksgiving with friends. He had been an exchange student at Heartland Community College to get an IT degree. It was a State Department exchange program, so he'd been thoroughly vetted. He'd visited before, following the completion of the program, but he was turned away in Chicago. His passport was taken and returned to him only after he got off the plane in Egypt. He says he was told, "Why would you celebrate Thanksgiving? It's a Christian holiday." He was also told they didn't believe his reason for a visit, that they believed he was here to live and work. It is true, he had no return ticket and had recently ended an IT job in Dubai, but he told GLT he was meeting with American friends and they were going to Trinidad and Tobago for a music festival and had not bought those tickets together yet. Does this raise questions of consistent application of policy at the borders?
Absolutely. And it also raises serious questions about whether he was targeted by virtue of his country of origin and perhaps his religion. And the ACLU has consistently opposed both the actual Muslim bans that President Trump issued in his executive orders, both the text of them and the scope and the application of them. And so we'd be very concerned about whether a law and executive orders were being applied fairly and with consideration of what we believe the Constitution requires.
The feds don't have to say immediately why they're denying somebody entry, though one can petition for a reason. Should that change? That they don't have to give an accounting immediately.
So, yes, that should change. I don't look for it to change immediately, but one of the hallmarks of our American system has been restrictions on arbitrary government power. And government shouldn't be afraid to actually articulate the reason for its actions or its decisions. We require courts to do that. As you know, when you see a judicial opinion, it's an opinion. This is why the court ruled. They back it up by reference to legal provisions or constitutional provisions. We should expect that. We should demand that of all government operators.
Colleen Connell is the executive director of the ACLU of Illinois. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us, Charlie. It was really significant for us to be able to come and talk.
She'll be at the We the People Listening Tour at the Chateau this evening at 6 o'clock. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, where your business is kept local. CEFCU is locally owned and decisions are made locally, which means they're committed to your business. You can find out more at CEFCU.com/owner. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, life on the road as a touring musician, a difficult but challenging and sometimes rewarding endeavor. There is a lot to consider when replacing a tree in your yard, so it pays to ask an expert like Patrick Murphy, who helps a listener in Bloomington make that all-important decision on this edition of GLT's Grow.
What's better than planting a new tree in your yard? Planting trees in unison with your neighbors. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Mr. Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Ms. Kennedy, hello. How are you?
I'm splendid. And today on GLT's Grow, we have got a great question that was submitted at WGLT.org/grow. This comes from Anne in Bloomington, Illinois. She says, my next door neighbor and I are looking to replace our dying purple ash trees with a tree that is hardy, not overly subject to pest damage, and attractive. What would you suggest? And she also says, what do you think of a bald cypress for each of us? So you're the arborist in the room. I figured you have lots of good ideas.
And Anne's predicament is an opportunity for all of us, really, because she's highlighting some of the typical dilemmas that go along with purchasing and selecting a tree, and then deciding where you're going to plant it. And that's kind of how it's approached usually. But if you kind of go at it from the other direction and bald cypress is the first tree that Anne wants to know about, and I think that's a wonderful tree.
Great.
It's native. And what's important about that is that native trees that are within their range, they're part of the cycle of life. They provide food and shelter for all different kinds of life. Compare that to adaptable trees, which we all love also.
Oh, certainly.
So what's an adaptable tree? A ginkgo tree.
Oh, okay.
How many native critters are benefiting from the ginkgo? Well, it's far less than, say, the bald cypress or the white oak, the state tree. And another thing that Anne's question reminded me of, Laura, is the typical residential scenario. A lot of people live on half to three-quarter or even one-acre lots where the house is placed in the center. Once you start looking, say if Anne looks up the height and spread of a bald cypress and she discovers this is a massive tree.
Well, it's a good thing she's asking with her neighbor because she's going to have to share space.
Right, that's right. And there also may be an opportunity. So you're looking up all this information about the bald cypress and, you know, because its spread can be as much as 120 feet in a lifetime.
Oh, my goodness.
That means it needs to be 60 feet away from a building, right?
Oh, my goodness.
half of its spread from the trunk to one side, that'd be 60 feet. Now, you might need to add 10 feet to that so that when the tree has reached its potential or close to it, you can mitigate the chances of wildlife using the tree to get on your house, to get in the house. That's something we've talked about before.
Yep.
So once somebody does all this math and does some of the thinking and pondering about really excellent tree selection and where to put them, you might discover this residential scenario is more relevant. So what's that mean? Well, if you plant this tree with these distances in mind, resisting the temptation to plant it where it would look cute the day it's brought home.
Right.
Right? That never works, folks. Never. So what happens when you do that is it looks great a little sooner, but then the problems become bigger as the tree grows as well.
Right.
So all manner of problems. So let's stick to the issue of selecting the tree. A lot of typical residential settings, the tree location is perfectly between or close to center point between two houses. Then you have a collaborative situation where neighbors come to an agreement on a tree, and you might even get some help cleaning up the leaves after you've planted it with
Great.
Their help, too.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, planting ideas for Anne and her neighbor. And I just love that.
I do, too. And if it's for the front of the house, there's a lot of planning goes on for this because trees frame our houses. They bring them to scale on the property. But if you also look at how a lot of people have planted trees, and it's a correct way to plant them, and they've not done anything wrong, but what they've done is they've preserved an obvious recognition of where the boundaries are.
Right.
And when you get away from that presentation, you know, the neighbors know where the boundaries are. But if the landscaping and the tree placement between homes, particularly the public view, is done with harmony and cooperation, the end result is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Because we realize the benefits of proper tree selection and placement. Even the pioneers understood this simply by planting trees where they cast shade in the summer and they block the wind and they reduce drifting in the winter when they're placed in these proper locations.
I've got a question. Now, if Anne wants to plant a particular tree, and let's say her neighbor, she wants to meet, maybe they think they wanted to get two separate types of trees.
Okay.
Can you think of two that would go really well together, that one that Anne could plant, one that her neighbor could plant, that they could be juxtaposed near each other, maybe two or three trees that are different varieties of trees?
I think that's a fantastic question, and it also helps us with the diversity that's important.
Oh, yes.
In selecting our trees, you know, so if Anne has a bunch of bald cypress already,
mm-hmm.
yes, it is an indication that that tree likes it there.
Yeah.
But it's good to have some diversity in case a problem comes blowing down the road. So if we selected a bald cypress, which has the feathery type of needle leaf,
mm-hmm.
which falls off, it's a deciduous cone-bearing tree. All those needles fall off, you might want to accompany it with another conifer that keeps its needles.
All right. What's a good one you like?
I like white fir.
Okay.
And I like ponderosa pine. It's the Tree Tuesday feature here at the Arboretum this week. Right?
Oh, cool.
So, but then you could also say, well, we've got a conifer, so I want a leafy tree to contrast the growing season presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So we always talk about black gums. We love black gums.
Yes, we do.
An underappreciated native tree here in the Midwest. But I like swamp white oaks and bur oaks a lot, too, because they have this very muscular branches and bark. And when the leaves are gone, there's really still something there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got this kind of muscular, clumpy thing. And even the lovely hawthorn, there are many species of hawthorn. They give us some winter character. And again, that's another tree that when the leaves are gone, there's still clearly a tree there, and they're awesome to decorate during the holidays.
You know, and I think this would be a lot more work, but it would be kind of sweet as well if they looked at maybe having a fruit tree or something. That way they can both share, if they get like an apple tree, they could both share the fruits of that apple tree and make pies for each other.
And they could be fashionable as well as charitable, because edible landscapes are growing in popularity, and they get people out into the landscape, and they might turn the reluctant gardener into a fantastic gardening dynamo, because
Aww.
You could have your break right there in the garden, have an apple,
mm-hmm.
have some, you know, blueberries are a great thing to mix in there too.
But
we are talking about trees. But that would be a great way to go. And also something I've seen done that is an interesting look is, say they do decide upon a bald cypress, and they decide that they have room for not one, but they have room for two or three.
Okay.
Consider buying the same tree in two or three different sizes.
Oh, yeah.
To create the naturalized appearance. And kind of that is also a fashionable trend in landscaping, or naturalized landscapes. But seeing those three different sizes of the same trees does have a very natural presentation. And it can also create the illusion of space with the larger trees in the front and the smaller trees towards the rear.
Oh, clever.
And it's kind of like building the model railroad set, right? So you want to create the illusion of distance. Japanese gardens also use this technique.
That's very clever. Okay, well, those are some really great suggestions.
Thanks for the question, Ann.
Yeah, thank you so much. And again, that was sent to WGLT.org/grow. Now, coming up next week on GLT's Grow, oh, we're protecting against old man winter. You got to do it. Well, you got to do it in this zone, Zone 5, for certain. And we would love to hear from you if you've got a gardening question as well. We'd love for Murph to get his hands on it. Go to our website and submit it there. Fill in the form, send it along to us. And also, we welcome your photographs with those as well. It always helps to illustrate whatever your question may be. We would just love to hear from you. Submit the questions at WGLT.org/grow.
You can download the Grow Podcast weekly at iTunes or WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Life on the road as a touring musician is tough. Bloomington's Matthew Curry says it took him a while to learn how to handle the stress and monotony of being on the road for weeks or months at a time. Curry is back in town for a charity concert benefiting the Community Cancer Center Saturday night, ahead of his annual Fender Bender evening at the Castle Theater. Curry, with acoustic guitar in hand, sat down with GLT's John Norton to talk about the rhythm of the road.
The road of touring is littered with the bodies of musicians and abuse, and it can be a tough way to make a living. How are you working on that? What kind of strategies do you have to make touring work for you and maybe be efficient with your career?
I just try to get sleep when I'm out there. I think that's the most important thing.
Is it something that took a while to learn to do that?
It not necessarily the sleep in its own, but just it took a while to learn in general, the whole touring thing. Like, I remember we hit the road pretty heavy right when I got out of high school.
Which is 4 years ago now.
Yeah. I remember, like, things changed so quick. I was just so used to being a normal person going to school and stuff. And not that I'm not I'm a guitar player. I guess I can't say that I'm normal. I remember, like, I was having anxiety attacks and stuff and all this terrible stuff. You know, my chest was locking up. I'm like, oh, geez, what's going on with me? And realized just because everything was changing so rapidly that, you know, my mind was kind of, you know, I was just freaking out a little bit. But I've learned how to cope with that, and I've learned that it's always better to get an extra few hours of sleep than stay up and have those extra few drinks with the guys, you know, so...
So there are strategies that you use, that you've learned to use anyway, what you can and can't do.
I guess, yeah. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it affects everybody differently. Yeah, I just try to eat healthy and sleep. You know, nobody's doing the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. The rock and roll part, sure, but not, you know, nobody's out partying or anything like that, you know.
You sort of realize it's a job, and there's fun along with this job, but it's a job.
Yeah.
I mean, you're out there on the road. I mean, there's a lot of time to yourself out there because you're playing, what, 2 or 3 hours maybe?
At the most.
At the most, and maybe including warm-up and all, you know, sound check and all that?
Yeah.
So the rest of it is out on the road all by yourself or with the guys? And
for the most part, it gets, you know, you start to really find out certain things about people that can bug you when you're stuck in the van with the same four people, you know, so, cracking jokes in the van.
So you're relatively young. So what did you learn after a while how to deal with that?
And this is going to sound silly because it's kind of out of the blue, but one of our big rules, you know, because I'm sure you've done plenty of road trips, you know, is if somebody's got to go, we don't hold it. We stop. And, you know, so that way if somebody's hungry, we stop. We get food. You know, we try to not abuse ourselves, you know, and nobody tries to be heroes and drive for, you know, a million hours at a time or anything like that. But
so even there's a strategy on who's driving and how long.
Yeah.
You trade off, the four of you?
Yeah. Yep, and we're all just waiting for the day when we have a bus and a driver. That sure would be nice.
Lay down. Well, I'm glad you brought your guitar with you. After you play a song for us, right?
Sure.
That's why you brought your guitar. Yeah. I want to ask you about your circle of acquaintances after this and maybe some of the people you've leaned on, other than maybe Steve Miller, who we've talked about in the past, too.
Yeah.
So
sure.
What's in your box this morning?
This is one I wrote with a good friend of mine, Greg Neville, and it's a song called The Great Midwest.
As the sun hits the horizon yields the light of the moon, my mind takes me back in time to a lazy afternoon. On the banks of the Mackinac, as I threw in the line, almost heard my daddy call, "Son, you get back sometime." Soul heal in the great Midwest.
troubled times, so many troubled places. I've heard my share of come on lines from lonely empty faces. But no matter where I roam, I long to get back in time.
It goes on into a solo and bridge. And,
love it. Oh,
thanks, man.
I love that song.
Of course, it's still early for us guitar players. My voice hasn't quite gotten around yet.
As we're recording this, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning. So just, I love that. I love the reference to the Mackinac River.
Oh, thank you, man.
I love the reference to your dad. And it has a Mellencamp sound to it as you're doing acoustic almost, you know?
That was kind of the idea behind it. Obviously, him being from Bloomington,
Indiana. Yeah.
And so we, that was kind of something that actually we were sitting in my basement just throwing the lyrics around and, well, what kind of tune do we put these in? And he actually says to me, he's like, well, what about like kind of a Mellencamp kind of thing? And I was like, well, actually, I've been working on this little riff. So it just kind of fell together in a matter of a couple hours. So that's one of those things. It's a really great feeling to walk away from a songwriting session and with, you know, what? Something that just fell in your lap almost, you know.
I can't wait to hear it plugged in, but I also love the reference, the local references when you bring in the Mackinac. Chicago Farmer does that quite a bit, you know, and I love those local references. You and again, you referenced your dad in this, and I wanted to ask you about this circle of people that you surround yourself with, whether it's musicians or managers or venues, stuff like that, because you don't have your dad. He would have been helping you out probably quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Who are those people? You've mentioned Steve Miller in the past, someone who's is always there for advice. Keeping you straight, keeping you narrow, you know, keeping you focused. Who are some of those other people in your circle?
You know, obviously my family, my mom, my brother, especially, who is my best friend. And him and I spend a lot of time together. And
well, you mentioned in past interviews the two of you have become even closer since you went on the road. And he's your twin brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you continue to become close that way, it sounds like.
Yeah.
What do you give to each other? Because he's in a different place than you are, and you're in a different place than he is. How do you help each other out?
Just talking, you know. Not a ton of kids lost their father when they were 16, and, you know, they're two brothers who, obviously, you know, boys who wanted to be nothing but their dad. And so, you know, we talk about him a lot, and, you know, I'm really thankful to have him, and I'm sure he feels the same way, and it's one of those things, you know. I've always got his back, and he's always got mine. So no matter what the situation is, and some of my old buddies too. I still, you know, of course we don't see each other as much as we used to with everybody, you know, starting their careers and me being on the road a lot.
Well, you know, that sounds important. It sounds like your brother is the one that really grounds you, and probably your mom as well, but you're hinting at your friends as well that kind of keep you grounded a little bit, too.
Yeah, well, it's always just nice to...
Well, what I'm getting at is Michael Jordan, you know, the superstar he became, he would always go back home to North Carolina and play poker with the guys he grew up with. That sort of kept him grounded. You know, he said that, you know, go back in a smoky room with just the guys smoking cigars and playing poker, and he was just one of the guys. He wasn't Michael Jordan then, you know?
Yeah, and I know for me, and I'm by no way comparing my career in music to his career in basketball, but it is always, excuse me, good to just pretend like you don't tour or make music or, you know, and just be with the buddies for a night and, you know, maybe play poker or me and my friends are real Harley enthusiasts, so we'll all go out riding together and, you know, get lunch somewhere. And so,
well, you want to play something else?
Yeah, I'll play the song Luana. It's off the Electric Religion album, and kind of weird story about that. We worked on that album for a long time, Greg and Jeff Paxton and Eric Nelson and I, and had this song that Jeff and I wrote, and we're like, well, we don't really know if this fits with what we have, and so...
It's more of a pop number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of almost got a bit of a Beatle-y kind of British, I guess, kind of thing to it. So we're like, oh, we'll stick it on the very last of the album, and turned out to be most people's favorite song. Huh. So
you just never know, do you?
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. It's so weird. But we'll give that one a go.
All right.
Bloomington native Matthew Curry talking with GLT's John Norton. Curry plays his annual Fender Bender this Saturday night at the Castle Theater. Curry says Fender has donated a Fender Stratocaster to raffle off at the show, with proceeds benefiting the Community Cancer Center. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. I would hold her in my-